This is Radio EcoShock with your host, Alex Smith.
Calgary, Alberta is the headquarters of Canada's boom and bust oil and gas industry, including the infamous tar sands and fracking. It takes guts to live there doing exposés on the damage done. That's what investigative journalist and author Andrew Nikiforuk did for the past 25 years, and he's still at it. His latest book is Slick Water, Fracking, and One Insider's Stand Against the World's Most Powerful Industry. Andrew Nikiforuk, I've been reading and admiring your work for years. Welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Well, thank you, Alex.
Now, on this program, I've covered fracking in Pennsylvania, New York State, Montana, California, but I don't know much about fracking in my own country, in Canada. But just before we go there, I'd like to briefly talk about the oil patch, the Canadian tar sands. Can we get a quick update from you on what's happening there?
Well, with the fall in oil prices, there's a rather dramatic shakeup going on in places like Fort McMurray and also in the offices of some of the major oil and gas companies in Calgary. Everyone thought that the boom would never end, and everyone thought the price of oil would just get higher. And, of course, none of that has turned out to be true. And the markets for really heavy junk crude like bitumen seem to be declining, not growing. The economic fallout in China, you know, is another warning signal to this industry that the demand that everyone thought would be there for bitumen is simply shrinking. And then when you add all of the concerns about carbon liabilities and carbon emissions, the tar sands might not have the long life that certainly the Alberta government and the industry hoped it would.
Yeah, there's been 54,000 layoffs, I read just the other day, in Alberta and more in Saskatchewan. Shell just abandoned a $2 billion project that they had going. It's really hard to predict where this is going to go.
And there are lots of companies in the United States, too, that are fracking in the Bakken and elsewhere, and they've all declared bankruptcy or posting incredible write-downs. This is a major dramatic shift, and what it will mean in the end is, well, more volatile oil prices for sure, I would think, but also that, you know, the industry is being given a very strong message that it is a dying industry, not a growing one.
And then we have Canada's top tar sands salesman and the anti-climate activist, Prime Minister Stephen Harper. What does his loss in October in the election just held, what does that mean for Canada's role now?
Well, hopefully it means a different role. I mean, Harper was, again, a great promoter of pipelines and a great promoter of exporting bitumen, which if you take all the climate scientists in the country and put them together, they'd say, look, this is not something, this product is too dirty for us to export, and we really need a program to get off bitumen. And it might be a 30 or 40 year program to do that. And hopefully with Trudeau, we might begin to see a recognition of the real economic and environmental liabilities associated with tar sands and any expansion of the tar sands. So you can't really address climate change and approve pipelines at the same time. It's craziness.
You know, along those lines, in 2012, you wrote a really unusual book titled The Energy of Slaves, Oil, and the New Servitude. Could you just give us a snapshot of what your argument was there?
Well, it was a philosophical book really looking at why we use energy the way we do and how high energy consumption has really changed modern life. It's very much responsible for our obsession with quantity of stuff, our obsession with speed, our obsession with the concentration of companies and the concentration of governments has changed the very nature of what it means to be human. And so the book basically asks the question, well, you know, how do we change that? Now, the cheap energy has been used to create this incredibly complex civilization. And now that cheap hydrocarbons are on their way out, and we're only left with extreme and difficult stuff, and green and renewable energy, which also comes with its own unique set of challenges and problems and lower energy returns, then where do we go? So for me, it was a really philosophical look at those questions.
Okay, let's get to your new book. Is there a lot of fracking in Canada, and where is it mainly located?
Oh, Alex, there's a monstrous amount of fracking taking place in Canada, and it's an issue that most Canadians are not aware of. So there's an enormous amount of fracking taking place in northern British Columbia. In fact, some of the world's largest fracks have taken there, and the fracking of shale basins there has caused hundreds and hundreds of earthquakes. Same thing in Alberta. We have an enormous amount of fracking has taken place in the province. It used to be largely vertical fracks, but in the last 10 years, we've seen a lot of fracking of horizontal well bores, particularly along the eastern slopes of the Rockies, where companies have been chasing after tight oil deposits, similar to the Bakken in North Dakota. And there again, the fracking has created a number of problems, everything from gas migration to groundwater contamination to really significant earthquakes, the highest being 4.8 up in Fox Creek, Alberta, which pose a real threat to public safety because nothing has been built to withstand that level of man-made seismic activity.
Now, the heroine in your book is Jessica Ernst. Do you want to just give us a little introduction? Who is she?
Well, she's a remarkable woman and very different kind of character when you think about the enormous controversies that have been associated with fracking. So she's different in the sense that she's part of the industry. I mean, for more than 25 years, she worked for some of the country's largest oil and gas companies, including Encana, Murphy Oil, Chevron, the Great Canadian Oil Sands Company. So she brings to the story the perspective of somebody that knows the industry intimately, who thought it was actually being fairly regulated, and that if something went wrong, it would be addressed in due time. And she discovered that none of that was true. The other interesting thing about Jessica Ernst is that she's incredibly stubborn, obstinate, and incredibly determined. And she's now been in a lawsuit with the government of Alberta, Encana, and the energy regulator for 10 years. And what makes this, again, unique is that in most of these cases, people get tired, they get worn out, they get burned out, and they settle. And when they settle, any record of contamination is taken off the public record. You know, the companies will give you a check, you sign a confidentiality agreement, and then it all goes away. And regulators love this because then there's really no record of groundwater contamination or any problem. And why Jessica's case is so important and why I think industry and government are so concerned about it is, one, she's got the evidence, and two, she will not settle out of court. She wants it all on the public record.
So what brought her to the breaking point of saying, I'm going to have to sue the government and the company that I had worked for in Canada?
Well, what happened briefly was during an incredible fracking boom in central Alberta in the Horseshoe Canyon, Encana fracked a number of shallow cobalt methane wells. And one of those wells, it fracked directly into fresh water and affected a number of aquifers around the community of Rosebud. And when this was brought to Jessica's attention and when she started to investigate it and ask questions, you know, she ran into a brick wall with the regulator. Alberta Environment then conducted a really bogus investigation. I mean, to this day, Alberta Environment does not have a protocol for investigating methane contamination of groundwater related to oil and gas activities, which is astounding when you think that nearly 500,000 wells have been drilled in Alberta. And when she realized that the regulators weren't going to do the right thing, and when she realized that Encana was just ignoring it, she said, okay, I really have no choice here. I'm going to have to sue. And she did so reluctantly. I mean, nobody really wants to do this kind of thing. But she said, well, you know, groundwater is a public resource. And once it's contaminated, it travels. And you just can't walk away from that kind of abuse of a public resource. So she's been in the courts now for 10 years. Her case is going, actually, to the Supreme Court in January and February of this year in Canada, which is, again, a remarkable achievement.
You mentioned coal bed methane, and I've heard that in Australia and even in the UK, but I don't really understand. Are there two different kinds of fracking?
Well, no, there's not. I mean, fracking comes in all kinds of different ways. I mean, you can use gases to frack and crack rocks, such as nitrogen, and that's commonly used to crack open coal seams. You can use water, you can use petroleum distillate, gasoline, diesel fuel, you can use all kinds of different chemicals, and then you can also, and quite often you use a lot of sand or proppants to to keep these cracks open so that the gas or oil can move from the fractured rock formation. The fracking of coal seams has got a fairly long history and a very problematic and controversial one. So they started fracking coal seam in the San Juan Basin in Colorado back in the 1980s. They did the same in Alabama, in Wyoming, and everywhere they did, they ran into problems. Coal is much more shallow than most oil and gas formations. It's also one of the world's most highly fractured rocks. And cracking it even more ultimately is just going to release a lot of that methane that's trapped in that in the coal. And I was just in Wyoming last week, where I met, you know, dozens and dozens of ranchers who lost their water as a result of the fracking of shallow coal seams in that state.
So, speaking of history, one incredible story in your book concerns using nuclear weapons for fracking. Did that really happen?
It did. I mean, the history of fracking is almost like something that Monty Python might have written about, but it's all about the escalation of brute force. You know, in the 1950s, they were fracking largely with diesel fuel, napalm, water, and river sand. And it was Halliburton and Schlumberger that pioneered that sort of fracking. And they were often very shallow fracks, and they were vertical in the wellbore. There was no horizontal fracking at that time. And then in the 1960s, you know, scientists sort of thought, well, you know, this is very labor-intensive, all of this vertical fracking. You know, maybe there's a shortcut. Maybe we could just set off a bomb in some of these very tight oil and gas deposits that are not economic to drill at the moment and see what happens. So they did. So Project Gas Buggy in Colorado took a nuclear bomb, and they blew it up underground, about 3,000, 4,000 meters underground, only to discover that there really is no market for radioactive gas. So the Russians did the same thing and also found that there is no market for radioactive oil or gas.
This is Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith with my guest journalist and author, Andrew Nikiforuk. We're talking about his new book on fracking, Slick Water. What was the Alberta's government's response to complaints that fracking had ruined aquifers and people's drinking water? Did they come out to protect the public?
No, they didn't. What they did, number one, was they said, well, this is unfortunate, we'll look into it. But then their investigations were completely fraudulent, as I documented in the book. And then they said, well, it's all natural and it was always that way. There's always methane in groundwater. We shouldn't be too concerned about it. When in fact, you know, when Jessica Ernst was presented with that story, she said, you know, that's bullshit. And so she hired a hydrologist to actually go back and do a forensic look at groundwater around her community. And so she looked at, I think, at the record of 2,500 different water wells. And she found that only about four or five actually had any record. And when your water well is drilled and brought on, it is almost always tested for gas. And the public record will say gas present, yes or no. You know, there was less than half a dozen wells in her area that where there was gas present. And other scientists had said, too, the interesting thing about the coal basin that Encana and other companies fracked into later was that it was a very tight coal, and that, you know, the methane really clung to the coal seams, and it took a lot of experimental fracking to get it to migrate to the surface. And again, so, I mean, people did not have problems with methane coming into their water wells until this massive experiment had taken place by fracking the coal.
Another problem I didn't fully understand until I read your book is the noise pollution from fracking operations. What happened to Jessica Ernst's peaceful homestead near Rosebud, Alberta?
Well, there are lots of different noise sources, but the one that has really driven a lot of rural people crazy are the compressors. So these coal formations are underpressurized, and once you frack them and the gas is released, you need to draw that gas up, and that's what the compressor stations do. They kind of act like these very noisy vacuum cleaners on the landscape. And the noise got so terrible for Jessica Ernst, I mean, and these compressor stations were nearly a mile away, that she could not sleep at night. There have been cases in Wyoming where residents have been driven crazy by the noise, and they've actually gone out and, you know, with a 30-30 put holes in them. And then, of course, been arrested by the state police. But what happens when this kind of oil and gas activity comes into a community, it basically industrializes the community. You get noise from heavy traffic. because so many trucks are needed to service these low-producing wells. You get noise from the compressors, you'll get noise from the actual fracking activity and drilling activity, and the whole quality of life of a rural place dramatically changes. I mean, urban people would never tolerate the scale of industrialization that comes with fracking.
Right, and people went there to be peaceful in the first place. How does your story tie into terrorism? I mean, the police show up, and not just any police, on Jessica's doorstep. What happened there?
Well, it's, again, an interesting story. When Jessica went public with what happened to her water, the regulator responded by branding her a security threat and a criminal threat to the organization. And, I mean, this was a fraudulent claim. And they did so that they wouldn't have to talk to her, and hoping that they would terrify her and shut her up for good. And they really didn't understand Jessica Ernst. And they later admitted, 6 months after they had banished all communication with her, that, look, Jessica, you never were a threat to us. We know you are not dangerous, but you publicly humiliated us by pointing out how negligent we were, and that's why we banished you. And so a couple of years after they did this, the RCMP came to her door as well. In fact, just a week after she was on national television in Canada, and it was members of the anti-terrorist squad. And so when they came up to Jess's place, she grabbed her camera and started taking photographs of them to have a record of it. She also fortunately had some neighbors at her house at the time, so she had witnesses. And the police were quite startled, and they had arrived unannounced, of course, and said, look, you can't take pictures of us. We're plainclothes policemen. And Jessica invited them to sit outside on her porch in metal chairs, and it was about minus 15 degrees outside at the time. And then they proceeded to interview her. And what they really wanted to know was, and what she found was to be absolutely appalling. They wanted to know the names and the phone numbers and addresses of all the ranchers and farmers that had called her for help over the years on issues related to fracking. And there were hundreds of them. And she said, no way, you're not getting any of that information. And why are you here? And why are you trying to harass me? Are you trying to silence me? And in the end, the policemen, who were very polite, also were very sheepish. And they apologized three or four times. And whoever sent them there, whether it was in Canada or the government, I don't know. But it was an example of how the state can terrify ordinary people when they are merely doing the right thing and trying to hold the state and their government accountable for the greater good.
Now look, with this lawsuit against Encana and the government, is Jessica Ernst in it for the money, and how does she pay for what must be big legal bills?
Well, she's not in it for the money, but in order to get the attention of the government in Canada and the regulator, you have to pick a big figure for a lawsuit. So she has sued all of them for negligence in breaking the law, as well as violating her constitutional rights for $33 million. And that sounds like a big sum, but in Canada, no lawsuit ever settles for that amount of money. And she's not in it for the money. To her, the big issue is to put this abuse of groundwater and rural people and all on the public record. And that's simply her goal. And at this point in time, she has spent $350,000 of her own money on this case. In the last year, I think ordinary citizens across Canada and the United States have contributed somewhere between $20,000 and $30,000 to her case. And 15% of the proceeds of Slick Water will go to support her legal challenge here.
So your book seems to make the case that winning a final judgment isn't really the biggest goal. I mean, what are the reverberations around the world of Jessica Ernst standing up for this?
Well, they are many. The first is that she has the scientific evidence that demonstrates that everything industry has said about fracking is false, that fracking does contaminate groundwater, that fracking does release gases that travel into other well bores and other formations and into other pathways that comes to the surface. And she's proven as well that one of the really big issues with fracking is that it rattles the existing oil and gas plumbing on the landscape and aggravates the existing problems with leaking gases. And so she's got all of the goods there, and she's got a really, really tight case where she's caught a company fracking directly into groundwater and where she's caught a government that did not uphold the law and enforce the law. So if she is successful in the end, and if all of this is proven beyond any doubt in a court of law, then it could change the way fracking is regulated in Canada. Her case has already changed the attitudes of thousands of citizens about fracking. So in Newfoundland, Nova Scotia, New Brunswick, I mean, Jessica Ernst is hailed as a folk hero, and her case is hailed as an example of how no one can properly regulate this highly dysfunctional and uncontrollable technology.
You know, I have to admit, I came away from reading your book with a slight feeling of hopelessness. Yes, we have brave individuals, we have citizen groups toiling for truth, but what a great machine of corruption and protection for pollution, you know, coming from the very institutions that are supposed to be protecting the public, so they say. In your heart of hearts, Andrew, do you think fracking in the tar sands will go on until the land, water, and climate are ruined? Or is there some hope that we could turn this around and make it sane?
Well, I don't think we can really make this technology sane. It is brute force technology. And there is a form of fracking taking place in the tar sands, and it's called the steam injection. And there are just as many problems with that as there are with fluid injection in oil and gas and coal deposits. But I always think about St. Augustine, who said that hope had two very brilliant daughters, and one was anger at the way things are, and the other was courage, the courage to change the things that must be changed. And Jessica Ernst is one of those sisters. And whether she actually finds justice at the end of the day in her case, and I actually believe she will, but it will take a long time and will take enormous amount of energy and emotion to get there, that her case is really going to make a difference.
All right. So, Andrew, you have a long history of books and articles that matter. What are you working on next?
Well, at the moment, I'm just working on how LNG and fracking in British Columbia poses risks and challenges to this good province.
Ah, yes, the LNG story. That's worth a book or three. Okay, so from Calgary, Alberta, we've been talking with Andrew Nikiforuk, a writer and author on environmental rights and wrongs, living in the Dragon's Den. Find out more at andrewnikiforuk.com. His last name is spelled Nikiforuk. And you can look for Andrew's new book, Slick Water, Fracking, and One Insider's Stand Against the World's Most Powerful Industry. Thank you for your work all these years, Andrew.
Thank you, Alex.
I'm Alex Smith, reporting for Radio EcoShock. As always, you can download or forward these interviews as separate MP3 files using links in my weekly show blog at ecoshock.info.
Radio EcoShock.